Turning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. We continue with Dan McMillan explaining the Holocaust.
And yes, ma'am.
I have heard it said, in fact, read that, I have heard it said and in fact read somewhere that Hitler's antipathy toward the Jews was exacerbated by the fact that he was not allowed to enter an art academy when he sought it, and that as a result of that, he found that most of the judges who had turned him down were Jews, and that exacerbated his antipathy toward them. Is there any truth to this? Have you come across that?
It's a commonly broached theory. That the problem is that for the first 30 years of Adolf Hitler's life, the documentary record is almost non-existent. So there's no way of demonstrating this. We don't know if the judges who turned him down were Jewish. It's also unlikely that he would have known whether or not they were Jewish. On the other hand, Hitler's well-justified feelings of inferiority are well known. His feelings of envy and of humiliation and of anger are enormously important, and the success of so many Jewish Germans and Austrians in the art world, it's quite plausible to think that that put an edge on his hatred. But I think the best explanation for Adolf Hitler's hatred for the Jewish people comes from the fact that he was personally so deeply invested in the German victory, in a German victory in the First World War, because he'd been such a complete loser up till then in his life. And this was his first accomplishment, the first time he was respected by anyone. He had a purpose, which was German victory. Germany surrenders. A lot of people on the right wing of German politics blame the Socialist Party for the surrender. And since he and many other people believe that Jews are behind the Socialists, the Jews are the culprits for the defeat. That seems to be... But we can't say for sure, but that's our best educated guess as to the source of his hatred, which was ferocious, absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
There are a lot of books on the Holocaust and the murder of the Jews. I often wonder, though, what about all the gypsies that they gathered and all the gay people and all the medically stressed people? Are there books about that? I mean, do they celebrate Holocaust, Day also?
Yes, I mean, There are separate scholarly treatments of all of these different classes of victims. That's quite right. In my book, I really focus only on Jewish victims because I have wanted to focus on what is really kind of unique to the Holocaust, which is this goal of complete extermination, this complete dehumanization of the victims, and so on and so forth. Even to the gypsies, who suffered in very large numbers, the death toll was very high. And even though they were the targets of racist thinking, as were the Jews, it wasn't nearly as uncompromising as it was with respect to the Jewish people. So I don't have much to say about that, but on the just off the top of my head, on the mental patients who were murdered in the so-called euthanasia program, the seminal work is by a man named Henry Friedlander, and it's from, I've forgotten the title, but it's Friedlander, Henry Friedlander, and it's a very good book that explores that. There's also some good work by Michael Burley, B-U-R-L-E-I-G-H, British historian, who's written about that episode. Yes, the gentleman on the right.
Thank you for your presentation. I think it's very professionally thought out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Someone said, if we don't study history, we will repeat it. So I want to put that out there. My question is, do you think that what happened to the Jews by the Nazis have affected the mentality of the Jewish people in Israel and around the world with the treatment of the Palestinian people?
The short answer is that I'm not qualified to answer that question because I really don't know a whole lot about Israeli politics. Off the top of my head, I guess my guess would be that given the intensity of that conflict, the Palestinian conflict, and how long that it's gone on, I'm always kind of surprised by the degree to which the Israelis have been able to maintain the quality of their democracy, and the degree to which, although their security services often engage in quite a lot of violence against some of the Palestinian community, it's impressive to me, frankly, how hard they work to keep that in bounds and how much that troubles them, compared, for example, to the way our country reacted to 9/11. And so I wonder if that aspect of, not that I'm praising Israeli policy in the Palestinian question, I take no position because I'm not qualified to judge it, but I'm just saying in the context of that conflict, the degree to which they've been able to preserve democratic values is impressive to me. It wouldn't surprise me if a desire not to emulate their persecutors might have played a role, but I'm just purely speculating because I really just know very little about Israel. It's a fascinating question, and one, unfortunately, I can't really give a very intelligent answer to. Sir.
You know, when I was around 25 years old, I realized for complex reasons that I could have easily gotten a ticket to Dachau, or I could have made a good Nazi. And I wonder if there's not an existential question, really bedrock in your book and your argument, that basically there's no fundamental biological difference between the Germans of those days and all the rest of us. And then ultimately, how many of us in this room, had we been in Germany during those same cultural pressures, particularly if we'd been young in the 30s, would have done anything different? Because very few of us really could be heroes or martyrs, and if the Germans are no different biologically, then we're just lucky to have lived in a better culture. But we're all humans.
You know, I could spend 2 hours unpacking your question because it's so good, and it's so on the money. And that's not a complaint. I'm just trying to think about how I can answer briefly. The question, is there something uniquely damaged about the Germans, is kind of the central question that has been studied by people who specialize in German history ever since the Second World War. Around the middle of the 1990s, after trying this theory and that theory and the other theory, we kind of gave up and we kind of had to admit sort of what common sense should have told us, that they're human, like us. There's no such thing as a German brain, and they don't have a genetic predisposition to genocide. And there still remain all kinds of stereotypes about the Germans, like they're especially obedient to authority and so on, which I think is utter nonsense based on my reading of their history. But you know, you raised the sort of this question of, if we were put back in that time and place, we of course would not be ourselves, we'd be someone else. I guess the bedrock conclusion that I arrived at about human beings, because ultimately the hardest thing about studying the Holocaust, and I think the reason why it has taken so long for a book like mine to have been written, even though the research was there to write a synthesis of this kind 20 years ago, we just don't want to pull everything together and look at it square on because we're afraid of what we're going to learn about ourselves. And maybe it was easier for me to study this because I've always been an optimist, and I believe in people, so I was never so worried about that. But I guess my end of my rambling answer is that I think the worst thing learned about human beings is not that we're evil in any essential sense, but that we are completely malleable by our circumstances. And you take any human being, and regardless of from who, you know, what genetic material or what family background that person has, and you raise them with the wrong experiences, indoctrinate them with the wrong ideas, put them in the wrong circumstances, and they will do absolutely anything. And that's really quite terrible. But you can see this as effectively the shadow side and unfortunate side of something that otherwise has been very positive across the long history of humanity, namely that we are supremely adaptable. And not to want to sound Pollyanna, but just as we are adaptable to complete moral depravity, we are also adaptable to moral progress, which I think we've demonstrated in a lot of ways. Thank you for your excellent question.
Axis Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
To go around, brave decisions so easily made by men who won't serve on the ground. Don't need any reason, don't need any proof to start dropping bombs on their heads. The quarterly profits have gone through. But it won't happen here. olive branch long cast aside for bombs, tanks, bullets, and swords. My God has always been better than yours, and so we must fight to the death. I stand above you, I pray to my God. I watch as you draw your last breath. Breathing in hate, living in fear. Peace would be great, but it won't happen here. Love conquers hate, hope conquers fear. Never too late for the peace to start here.
Now back to Dan McMillan attempting to explain the Holocaust.
Yes, the gentleman on the right. You've been waiting a long time. Sorry.
Yeah. This question is a complex question and
good.
Potentially a controversial question in these surroundings.
So much better.
I'm from the Caribbean, so and you know. I find what you're trying to do, I must say, I think is quite important. I mean, this kind of trying to bring about an integrated social science, bringing different answers together to a very complex issue instead of trying to answer it in a very limited type of sense. Although those have their interests too. I mean, they help somebody like you to do what you did. To call a certain Holocaust unique against the history, for example, of black people coming to the West, being brought to the West as slaves, the slaughter, the horrific slaughter of Native Americans, of American Indians, where I'm from, the kind of wiping away of Caribbean people, simply wiping them away because they stood up to the white man. You know, when a white man showed up, they said, it's either you or I. Well, the white man had more weapons, so he won. So that's the first basis of the question, you know. The problem of deciding, is it more unique than other slaughters and stuff like that? About the whole notion of it being unique. Because if it's unique...
Can I, you know, sir, I think what I'd like to do, the question you've raised is so huge and so important, I'd just like to try and answer that.
Mm-hmm.
And then let other people ask their questions. It's not that I'm... Because I think, you know, what do I mean when I'm saying unique? This is hugely, hotly debated in all kinds of different contexts. And part of the problem is when you use the word unique... And especially, I guess, when you use it in the way that I have used it, people sort of feel that you are automatically saying worse, that the Holocaust is worse, that the suffering of the Jewish people was more terrible, that these victims were more important than those victims. At genocide conferences, this is one of the bad things about writing a book like this, you get to go to genocide conferences, which is kind of an experience that I think most of you would be happy to avoid. And, you know, And I'm not in any way saying worse. I am saying that the Holocaust is different from every other episode in history in the specific dimension, that is, in the way that it confronts us with existential questions. And that because of that, I think that that is why we give it a particular kind of importance and why it frightens us. But it is not in any way to suggest that the Holocaust is inherently more terrible than the Armenian genocide, the Cambodian genocide, or the Atlantic slave trade and slavery. That's a comparison, by the way, that has sort of simmered below the surface of American politics from time to time and has been the source of much contention. I mean, the short answer is you can't really compare them because these phenomena are so vastly different. But ultimately, when you're getting to a question of what is worse or what is more terrible or what is more important, you're ultimately getting into a value judgment that is completely subjective. And you can make, for example, the case that, you know, that slavery, because of the lasting damage that is done in our society, the persistence of racism today, the suffering of so many people across three centuries, you could argue that slavery hurt more people more grievously and did more damage, and in that sense is worse. I'm not taking that position. I'm simply illustrating that this is a question of subjective value judgment. But I guess to circle back to respond to the gentleman's question, I'm not really saying that the Holocaust was worse. Unique is altogether an unfortunate term. I'm just using it as a shorthand for the fact that I think we see it as being somehow in a category by itself, and I think I'm correct in making that assertion. Yes, the gentleman on the right.
Yes, could you comment on the unique role of ideology, specifically Daniel Goldhagen's postulate and Hitler's willing executioners, that Germans, if not biologically particular, did develop a unique strand of anti-Semitism that was so virulent that it can be called exterminatory and it wasn't shared by others?
Yeah, the gentleman refers to a very controversial and also very popular, commercially successful book in 1996, Hitler's Willing Executioners by Daniel Goldhagen. It was actually based on his PhD thesis in political science at Harvard. And the book is exceptionally well written with a lot of passion, and it makes a very forceful argument. And I think this goes a long way to accounting for its extraordinary popularity. The problem, however, is that the arguments of the book really just do not fly. And the gentleman has alluded to them, and there really are sort of two central contentions that Dr. Goldhagen makes in his book. The first is that the Holocaust happened and happened in Germany as opposed to some other country because German anti-Semitism was unique and uniquely terrible and not like anti-Semitism in any other country. The problem is Goldhagen really made almost no meaningful comparison to anti-Semitism in any other country. And this is really a no-no. This is kind of social science 101. You don't make a claim that this country, Germany, the United States, France, Belgium, whatever, is unique, unlike every other country in some important way, unless you compare that country to a lot of other countries. And even worse for his argument, had he done so, he quickly would have seen something that historians of anti-Semitism can tell you right off the bat, which is that pretty clearly anti-Semitism was far more widespread, intense, deeply rooted, and violent in Eastern Europe and on the territory of the Soviet Union than it was in Germany during the first, say, three decades of the 20th century. So,
but they all want marriage to be like it was in the good book. I want a marriage like they had in the Bible, they had in the Bible, they had in the Bible. I want a marriage like they had in the Bible, because the Bible tells me so. Abraham and Sarah had a marriage, but she could not bear him. A kid. So Sarah gave Abraham a slave girl, and pretty soon they did it, and she did, Lord, Lord. Yeah, pretty soon they did it, and they did it, and they did it, and they did it, and she did. Now I know slavery was banned, but a woman should be free to give a slave girl to her husband. I want to all the marriage like they had in the Bible, like they had in the Bible, like they had in the Bible. I want to marry like they had in the Bible, because the Bible tells me so. Now Othniel and Aksaw had a marriage, because she was a battle prize he won. Yes, he fought to win Caleb's daughter, and he was Caleb's brother and his son-in-law. Yeah, he was Caleb's brother and his son. Now I know, woo, it sounds like incest. Yes, it does. But a woman should be proud to be married off and princessed. A woman all the marriage like they had in the Bible, like they had in the Bible, like they had in the Bible, baby. I want to marry like they had in the Bible, because the Bible tells me so. Now if two brothers brothers live together and one dies, the other brother must marry his brother's widow. For this is pleasing, yes, it's pleasing in God's eyes. And if he should refuse, then she should steal his shoes and spit right in his face. It's right there in the Bible. Now Jezebel and Ahab had a marriage. She began usurping all his power. She was wicked, of course, but he could not divorce her. So he had her thrown right off a tower, Lord, Lord, and sent the dogs her carcass to devour. Now I know. Sounds excessive. But a woman should submit to her husband or be made a mess of. A woman won't marry like they had in the Bible, because the Bible tells me so. Now if a man should take a woman to be his, and if it turns out he thinks she's not a virgin, well, then her parents have a chance to prove she is. And if they let her down, then every man in town should stone her till she's dead. It's right there in the Bible. Deuteronomy. Now Solomon and Naamah had a marriage, and they were together all their lives. Yes, she was his, and he was pretty busy, because she was one of 700 wives. Lord, Lord, yes, Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now I know. That's illegal. But a woman should be one of as many wives as her man can inveigle. I want to marry like they had in the Bible, because the Bible tells me so. I want to fool like they fool.
Now for something completely different.